Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Today we'll be hearing about the food system in the United States. On one hand, it's been great to witness the growth coast to coast of farmers markets in nearly every town and city. And in many cities now, a local and federal program allows food stamp recipients to use their coupons at the farmers market to buy fresh local produce. It's farmers markets, as it turns out, that have proven to be the catalyst for getting people to see instantly that having a secure local food source and buying locally is good for the health and well-being of the community. It's become the heart of an emergent movement for cultivating community-based economics at the local and regional level. On the other hand, does anyone feel that our government has really gotten a grip on food safety, especially regarding the food products of industrialized agriculture and food processing? Because during the Bush administration, drastic budget cuts to the regulatory agencies were coupled with so-called business-friendly rules that actually allowed food processors to limit the very infrequent visit by the few inspectors left on the payroll to only one particular part of the plant that would be determined by the plant manager. And the revised rules also allowed food processors often to determine for themselves what, if any, problems might exist at their plant and what they might do to fix the situation. It's yet another area in which the right-wing ideology that all regulation is bad has endangered us all. In addition, is it really good for all those Americans who eat industrially produced beef to be ingesting meat products formed with what's known as pink slime? That's the glop that results when parts of the cow carcass are pulverized and treated with ammonium hydroxide, as became public knowledge only about 6 weeks ago. And similarly, industrially produced beef often contains a binding agent, transglutaminase, and this is known as meat glue in the industry. Ugh. Why don't we know this? Well, unlike in Europe, our food labeling laws are now so business-friendly that they don't require American food processors to tell us whether we're ingesting genetically modified crops or the antibiotics or bovine growth hormone that were fed to dairy cows. Also, just a few weeks ago, a deceased dairy cow in the Central Valley of California was found to have mad cow disease, more properly called bovine spongiform encephalopathy. And there was only one such cow found, I want to emphasize. However, it's a worrisome development. There are so many issues involved with food safety that I'm pleased to say we are about to hear from an extremely informed person who works on the front lines of the struggle to fix our food system. My guest today is Andrew Kimbrell, one of our country's leading public interest attorneys specializing in agricultural, environmental, and patenting law. His major victories include numerous legal actions that have halted the commercialization of genetically engineered wheat, rice, biopharmaceuticals, alfalfa, and salmon. His legal work was also a critical element in the rescinding of patents on basmati rice, broccoli, and a number of animals, if you can believe that. He also initiated the lawsuit against the federal EPA that resulted in the Supreme Court victory, requiring the EPA to begin regulating greenhouse gases as part of their clean air regulations. In Washington, D.C., Andrew Kimbrell is the executive director of two public interest institutes, the International Center for Technology Assessment and the Center for Food Safety. As one of the foremost experts on agricultural policy, he was the general editor of a book I highly recommend, Fatal Harvest, The Tragedy of Industrial Agriculture. Fatal Harvest is a big coffee table size book with not only very informative, insightful text, but beautiful pictures of what the agrarian model of a food system looks like the small diversified farms, and then what those big stripped out fields where everything's been taken out but the cash crop, as you drive along the interstates and see pictures of that juxtaposed. It's really an excellent book, Fatal Harvest. More recently, he was the author of Your Right to Know. The subtitle is Genetic Engineering and the Secret Changes in Your Food. The Center for Food Safety, among its many projects, has produced a comprehensive report on the hundreds of farmers and businesses being sued by Monsanto, and it has established a legal helpline for them. He and the Center for Food Safety have become leaders in policy and in grassroots efforts to transform our food system. He's testified before numerous congressional and regulatory hearings, and in 1907 he was named by The Guardian, an international paper that comes out of the UK, as one of the, quote, 50 people most likely to save the earth, unquote. Andrew Kimbrell, welcome to All Together Now.
Great to be with you today.
I'd like to start by hearing what your senses of what's happening now with regard to our food system. What's the big picture right now?
You know, it's remarkable, Charlene. When you look at how, I mean, you know, food is the most intimate relationship, right, we have with the environment. I mean, it's critical to each of us every day. And yet we don't have a food agency in the United States of America. We have the Food and Drug Administration, which where food plays second place, and almost all the heads of the FDA, as the current one is Peggy Hamburg, are all in the drug area. We've never actually had a food agency, and instead of that, we have some food being regulated at the FDA, some at the USDA, some at the EPA. So, for example, meat is in the at the USDA, eggs and poultry is at the FDA, some genetically engineered crops are at the EPA. So you have a regulatory tangle of no coordination and a totally broken system that is both underfunded and in a confused state. And I've compared it to the Homeland Security effort. I think it's long overdue that we got all those pieces of the agencies together into one coherent food agency that can deal with food safety issues and all the other myriad issues that you very well outlined in the beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm. It also seems strange to me that all the other industrialized countries that are our peers, say, for instance, in Europe and elsewhere, they have cabinet level or minister posts for the environment and perhaps for these issues you were talking about, too, whereas we have agencies, right? The Food and Drug Agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, they're not cabinet level. They're really not given that much importance. Only the USDA is a cabinet-level position. And I'm kind of wondering what your assessment is of the people President Obama put into these positions. I realize people can only do so much with a giant corporate system, but I would love to hear how you feel Tom Vilsack is doing as the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, and as you say, Peggy Hamburg at FDA and Lisa Jackson at EPA. Are they better or worse than you expected on Inauguration Day?
You know, Charlene, it's been very disappointing. You know, on one hand, we have somebody like Kathleen Merrigan at the National Organic Program who's done a bang-up job, just a great job at really pushing organic, at consolidating its position at the USDA, and helping organic be the fastest-growing sector in American agriculture today. So the NOP is doing well. I mean, it's not that there's no issues with, you know, the organic standards, but it is certainly not what we faced during the Bush administration, which was an all-out war on the organic label. That's not happening. We're getting a lot of cooperation. Having said that, that's the good news. Having said that, the bad news is that Tom Vilsack, of course, was governor of Iowa, which is, you know, corn country and industrial ag country. He was named, I think, in 2001 as the Biotechnology Industrial Organization's Governor of the Year.
Oh, dear.
Governor of the Year, yeah. And he has, when governor, he was very much investing in biotechnology, including a multi-million dollar bust in trying to get genetically engineered animals into the factory farm system, which failed. When he left his governorship, he joined a law firm, which I'm very familiar with because that law firm opposed us in many of our suits to halt the illegal planting of GMOs, including a Supreme Court case that we fought a year and a half ago in the Supreme Court, where the law firm he joined was actually opposing us. So Vilsack was an extremely poor choice. He has, I would say, their position that we're seeing now at the USDA on genetically engineered crops, for example, which we can talk about, including this new group of genetically engineered crops that is promoting 2,4-D and dicamba and some of the worst herbicides, has been an absolute carte blanche, worse than the Bush administration. They're claiming they don't even have the authority to regulate these crops. Can you imagine that? At least the Bush administration said, you know, we think we're doing a good job regulating them, and fortunately we got seven or eight different courts, including the Supreme Court, to say, no, you're not. Yeah. Now, what the Obama administration should have said was, okay, we're going to get this act together. You know, this non-regulation of GMO crops has to stop. Instead, they said, you know what? We don't disagree that all these problems you're talking about, contamination of organic super weeds, hundreds of millions more pounds of herbicides, it's all happening, we admit, but we have no authority to do anything except approve them. That's their new position. Our hands are tied, which is grossly irresponsible. And then you get the FDA, which is, I mean, yes, they banned a small group of antibiotics, but in the big job they had to do in getting rid of the antibiotics and the overuse of antibiotics in our factory farm systems, they made them voluntary. Voluntary? Do you really think the factory farm boys are going to stop giving up their antibiotics, which they need because of the diseases that are passed in the horrific conditions of these factory farms with hundreds of thousands and millions sometimes animals put together, crammed together in these, confined animal food operations? Mm-hmm. Voluntary ain't going to do it. And then, of course, we recently saw that they failed to ban BPA. They have failed to order the labeling of GMO foods. All of their labeling provisions have been slow in coming, and many of the Food Modernization Act, which has recently passed, which should help the situation, many of those are not now being funded by the Republican Congress. So, yeah, we've got a broken system. The Obama administration has came in with big promises, and instead we're seeing some of the same old actors and sort of the corporate oligarchy, the corporate coup d'etat of these agencies by these corporations continue, and the cost, of course, has been continued problems with food safety in all of the ways that we think about food safety.
I see.
So, Charlene, for example, we have a massive increase in foodborne illnesses.
No, right.
Not a decrease, which you'd expect. We have seen no diminution in right now I think it's estimated that over 112,000 people die every year because of the obesity epidemic that we're seeing. So, we have 43 to 48 million people who are getting sick every year from foodborne illnesses because of the obesity epidemic to billions of dollars a year, including to children. We have a massive increase in obesity deaths and type 2 diabetes, which used to be called adult onset, but they can't call it that anymore because so many children are getting it because of these fast foods. The FDA was asked, we asked them, many others asked them to forbid fast food advertising for children. $4 billion a year is spent by the fast food company advertising on children's programs. We said, forbid that. You have the ability to do that legally. They refused to do that. And then, of course, we saw recently the one of the good things that came out of this administration was a cancer report that said one or two things you can do to help prevent cancer is to eat organic, because you're not taking in all those pesticides and herbicides and all those additives that we know are a major cause of cancer. But they haven't done, except for that report, they've done nothing to get rid of those additives, those toxins in our farming or in our environment. When I say food safety in its larger sense, it's not just foodborne illnesses, it's also the obesity epidemic and the cancer epidemic, including childhood leukemia and others that have been associated with toxins that are part of our industrial food production system.
That's right. There have been a number of studies that have linked obesity to ingesting all the toxins from our industrial agriculture system. And just the other day, a study came out saying they're finding it almost impossible to treat teenagers who develop what, as you say, used to be called adult onset, because they're just not responding to the drugs in the way they thought they would. So, again, they're saying the best thing you can do is not get this as an adolescent and watch your diet as a child, which means not ingesting all these toxins that are perfectly legal in our system, as you say. Well, what I'd like to move into is to hear about the situation with genetically engineered crops. Starting with the basic issues, you know, why do people say it's not harmful? Is it harmful? And the recent studies showing it hasn't actually increased yield at all. And then the specific crops and animals you've been involved with. I just want to say I had a guest on a few weeks ago who, like yourself, was just right in the center of all the action and had so much to tell us. Some of my listeners I heard from said they couldn't take it all in. There was just so much so fast. So we have time for a little tutorial here. And I would like to know where things stand now in the situation regarding genetically engineered crops and animals in our country.
Yeah, no, I get to that. One quick thing on the, you know, when you talk about fast foods and that last issue, you know, we're talking about sweetened drinks and all those things. People say, well, wait a minute, people should have a choice.
Yeah.
Just because you don't want to eat them, Charlene and Andy, you know, that doesn't mean we don't have, you know, the people choose them. So, you know, tough luck. And my answer to that is, give me the money in my lifetime. I get the last half. You know, century or more, give me the money they have spent advertising this stuff, and I can show what it does to children. I can show what it does to your body. We can show, have scientists showing, just give us, you know what, not all the money, give me half the money of the untold trillions they've spent in that time,
right.
And I guarantee you we could turn it around. You know, to say that people have choice when they're inundated
right.
every day with hundreds of ads, the average
right.
kid sees over 100 ads for fast foods a week on television,
right.
and not to
it's
mention...
It's not an
also,
informed choice. It's
no,
a manipulated
it's not,
choice.
It's been manipulated, so, you know, I find it one of the most disingenuous and irritating arguments I always heard. So all your listeners out there, if somebody gives that argument to you, please say, hey, give me the money. Let's play on an equal playing field, and then we'll see if there's choice.
Right.
As far as GMOs, I think I can simplify it a little bit because it can get very complicated very fast when you're
uh-huh.
talking about agrobacterium vectors and things like that. What happened is that there was a massive failure, scientific failure. The idea that you can fundamentally change the phenotype, fundamentally change the fundamental physical characteristics of crops by manipulating a gene or two turned out to be reductionist, silly science. So what we have now, all of the things you've heard about with vitamin A rice or, you know, drought-resistant crops or more nutrition or more taste, none of that's come true. In the 30 years and untold billions of hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, that in public and private investment, the biotechnology industry has yet to provide one crop food that is advantageous to the public. No one gets up in the morning wanting to buy a GMO food. It does nothing for you. No better taste, no more nutrition, no lower cost, no less calories, you know, no caffeine-free coffee, you know, calorie-free chocolate,
mm-hmm.
you know, no vitamin A, B, no more nutrition, no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So you may ask, since that's true, and they would, by the way, love to label and advertise if they were able to produce such a thing, but they have failed because it turned out that genetic engineering was no match for the complexity of the biology of our crops. However, they did manage a couple of tricks using bacteria genes and putting them into plants. And one of them, and the one that is right now, is between 80 and 85% of all the crops planted in this country and around the world, so without this we wouldn't be talking about this subject, is something called herbicide tolerant. And that means normally, and every gardener and farmer out there that's listening knows, if you spray a herbicide to kill the weeds and it gets on your flowers or your crop, it kills the crop. It doesn't just kill the weeds. Herbicides kill anything that's green.
Mm-hmm.
So they discovered a bacteria that they could put some genes into plants, rendered the plants immune to that herbicide. So instead of being careful with your herbicides, you could aerial spray them. So here's a whole field of soybean. Instead of being
mm-hmm.
real careful trying to get rid of the weeds, you got your airplane or your mass sprayer can go over. Now, this is really good for Monsanto and Dow and DuPont and those in the chemical companies who are the producers of these plants because they can sell more and more of their herbicides as large farmers find it much more convenient to aerial spray much less time, much less effort just to aerial spray all their crops than what they used to have to do, which was careful use of herbicides. That's why farmers use it, because they can mass spray their crops. It's 80 to 85% of all the crops here. And now, of course, what's happened, which was we predicted and a lot of other folks, was that when you have over 113 million more pounds of Roundup being used every year, guess what happened to the weeds? Basic biology.
Yeah.
The weeds have adapted.
Nature. You
know, nature. I hate when that happens. You know, so that you now have 20 to 30 million acres of weeds that say, hey, you can't kill us. We've been so drowned in glyphosate for so many since 1997 that we it doesn't kill us no more. And we're talking about pigweed, you know, which is taller than a you know 6-7 feet and had baseball bat type consistency. You can't kill that with a combine. You can't knock it over with a combine. This is machete time. So we have 20 to 30 million acres that have already become immune to Roundup, and that's going to increase massively. And all major weed scientists agree with this, and they've testified in Congress and elsewhere. So you think that the solution to this for any sane human being would say stop using this technology, which is making weeds, you know, super weeds that you can't kill with herbicides. Oh, but no, and that's not how the capitalist system works. So now what Dow has seen as an opportunity, they say, ah, as Roundup, which is the glyphosate being its active ingredient, as that becomes ineffective, Monsanto, which is the patent holder on all that, those crops, they're going to lose out. So they've come up with 2,4-D tolerant crops. Now, 2,4-D was one of the elements in Agent Orange, and it's highly toxic.
Yeah.
And it also volatilizes. That means under certain weather conditions, it gathers up in a vapor and can travel miles and then come down on somebody else's farm. So imagine you're an organic farmer, and you're doing very well, thank you very much. And then, you know, there's Charlene's wonderful, you know, organic corn or something. And meanwhile, you see a little cloud come over, a little rain comes down, and all that herbicide destroys your crop from 2 miles away, 3 miles away. So there's a group called Save Our Crops, which is conventional fruit and vegetable growers who have just filed legal actions. We've already filed ours at Center for Food Safety, but they filed theirs, and you can get on their website, Save Our Crops. They're conventional growers. They're terrified of 2,4-D and dicamba-resistant crops because they know that'll increase by hundreds of millions of pounds the use of 2,4-D and dicamba, and that's a real danger to their business because it could vaporize, come over, and destroy their crops, which are not herbicide tolerant. So corn and soy are the ones that are up. The Vilsack, as I mentioned before, Tom Vilsack, the USDA, have already indicated that they are going to approve 2,4-D corn and informally 2,4-D soy, that resistant soy. We have the comment period. We have commented, as have to our account, about 350,000 people saying, don't do this. We've gone to the White House, our coalition, and said, don't do this. This is a, Dave Mortensen, a weed scientist, prominent weed scientist at Penn State, has shown a chart where we're going to be looking at 700 to 800 million more pounds. Let me repeat that. 700 to 800 million more pounds of 2,4-D and dicamba each year by the year 2020, 2025, if they continue to use that. And Charlene, it's planned obsolescence. Because sooner or later, these weeds are going to be resistant to 2,4-D. As they are to Roundup. They're going to be resistant to dicamba. And by 2025, that's all the herbicides we have. It's like antibiotics. We don't have any more. It's peak herbicide time.
This is reminding me of that scene in Idiocracy where the crops are all shrunk down to nothing because they're...
Exactly. We're talking about a nightmare. And meanwhile, you know, the five big companies, Monsanto, Dow, DuPont, Syngenta, and Bayer, that are coming up with this nightmare scenario, they will keep selling more and more of their herbicides. So it's good for them. They sell the seeds. They sell the herbicides. More and more of it will have to be used as the crops get more and more resistant. And then finally, they won't be effective at all. And they get out with all their billions in profits. And who you think is going to pay for this unbelievable, if even possible, cleanup of America's crops? And these weeds aren't just going to stay in industrial agriculture. They're going to go everywhere. They will be everywhere, choking, you know, every farm and arable land that we have. So this is a total nightmare scenario, which is totally predictable, which is biology 01. And our government is not only asleep at the switch, but giving them a carte blanche and saying, you go ahead. Now, of course, we will sue them. As you mentioned, we've stopped huge numbers of crops in the past, and we hope to stop these. But that the Obama administration is giving this kind of a nightmare scenario carte blanche is, again, disappointing almost beyond words.
Yeah.
But that's a short story. You know, I don't like when people talk about biotechnology or even genetically engineered crops, because it sounds like there's this big discussion. It's not a big discussion. The only thing they've really come up with, because this BT is also, these insects have also become resistant to a much smaller group of crops called BT crops, where they take this Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a bacteria, and they put it into the crops. They genetically engineer part of the bacteria into the crops. And of course, insects now have become resistant to that. So that's going to go the same way as herbicide tolerant. But again, 80 to 85% of everything out there is this herbicide tolerant stuff. So we should be, the argument shouldn't be about biotechnology or genetic engineering crops. That's way too broad. Let's talk about what's really happening, which is the only thing they've really been successful at, where they make their money, is these herbicide tolerant crops, so they can sell their herbicides. So this is chemical companies selling chemicals to the extraordinary detriment of farmers, farm communities, our health, because we're talking, and by the way, all of this additional herbicide, if we don't stop it, will dwarf the amount of herbicides that we have been able to stop through organic. So it will reverse all of the advantages we've done on organic over the last 20 years. So this is it, folks. When you hear about genetically engineered crops or biotechnology, you see Monsanto squeezing the last drop out of this on NPR or for the farmers. No, this is chemical companies selling chemicals. That's all these major companies. They're all chemical companies. This is how they're going to sell their herbicides for as long as they can and as fast as they can until these weeds finally develop, adapt resistance to all of them, and then we have the nightmare I described. That's what this is all about. It's very simple. Chemical companies selling their chemicals with these terrible results, more toxics in our food, in our water, in our air, in our environment, in our bodies, in our communities.
Mm-hmm. And I think, too, it's important to note that in addition to this new wave that might very well go forward with the 2,4-D herbicide and then the other pesticides, in terms of the Roundup Ready, the genes that they've inserted into the plants, we're already eating that, right? If it's corn or soy in the United States, is it, what, 80% on the commercial market has this in it?
Yeah, well, we're talking about processed foods. So,
right.
Yeah.
If it says texturized soy protein, something like
right,
that on the box.
Right. So the big four,
people are eating
it. We're in court right now on alfalfa and on sugar beets, but the big four that are out there right now are corn, cotton, soy, and canola. And in corn and soy, because so many of their byproducts are in the processed foods, you know, everything from high fructose corn syrup to soy lecithin, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
We have on our website, by the way, on the Center for Food Safety website, and in the book you mentioned that I've written on genetic engineering, Your Right to Know, there's also a buyer's guide, if you will, a shopper's guide, both online for free in the book if you want to get it, that really help you steer away. If you stay away from processed foods in general, and then particularly any that have these corn or soy byproducts, you can pretty much avoid this foreign genetic material that is in the food.
Okay.
There are some studies, by the way. We finally are going to get some peer-reviewed studies, and you'll be seeing them over the next 8 or 9 months that do show and will show some significant health effects just from what's already out there, which is the Roundup.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also add, by the way, that the active ingredient of Roundup, for those out there probably know this, is glyphosate. And EPA has looked at glyphosate and has said that it is relatively safe. Well, we think there's issues with that. But several researchers found that when they sprayed just glyphosate into a pond that had, this was at University of Pennsylvania, just glyphosate into a pond, nothing happened to these frogs that they had in there. But when they poured Roundup in, there was 80 to 100% kill of all the frogs.
Yeah, I saw that, I think, on Nation of Change. Yeah.
It's
definite proof now that what they said was harmless is not at all harmless.
It turns out, Charlene, that the inert ingredients, particularly the surfactants, which means that which is on the surface, the chemicals they put into their mix, their brew of Roundup, that makes it stick to plants, it is unbelievably toxic. to organisms, including obviously amphibians. I mean, that kill rate is extraordinary. So while the Monsanto was saying, oh, glyphosate is so harmless, it's but the brew, the whole mix of it, and our EPA now, listeners better be sitting down when you hear this. When the EPA looks at Roundup, all they look at is the active ingredient. They don't look at all the other chemicals that are in the product.
So we have petitioned them and other groups
to say, hey, if you're going to look at Roundup, your duty is to look at the entire product. You can't just take one of the active ingredients and say, oh, we're not going to look at the rest of the product. That is just, you know,
unbelievable.
So hopefully they'll change that. I will see. I mean, again, we live more in a corporate oligarchy than a democracy, as you so well know.
Yeah.
But, you know, we will keep pushing to see that and I'm hoping that the administration will at least put off approving this new wave of 2,4-Ds on next year's
dicamba
until after the election, give everybody a chance to really look at the consequences of this catastrophic increase in herbicides that genetically engineered crops will bring.
Right. Well, more about that in a minute. We have to pause now for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, and I'm speaking with my guest, Andrew Kimbrell. Welcome back. This is Charlene Spretnak, and I'm speaking with my guest, Andrew Kimbrell, on All Together Now. And by the way, the website address for his center he directs, Center for Food Safety, is just that, written as one word, centerforfoodsafety.org. I want to move into the other half of your work with the Center for Food Safety, which is all the positive educational campaigns you do and efforts to really transform the food system, which, of course, incorporates educational campaigns about things we've just been talking about. In fact, I have to say, I looked on your website and I saw that slogan from a campaign in the early 1990s, untested, unlabeled, and you're eating it. And I thought, oh dear, we're still using the same slogan because we're still in the same situation in 2012. Nonetheless,
when you think back on it, you know, we have, and I don't mean just we at Center for Food Safety, I mean a broad coalition of groups and citizens groups. I mean, think of it. They approved genetically engineered tomatoes, it was defeated. They genetically engineered potatoes,
what I want to hear. Tell me the good stories now.
There's so many on your site.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, remember the Flavor Saver tomato?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it had no flavor to savor.
University of California at Davis developed it for them.
Our friends, exactly. Had no flavor to savor because of a market campaign that we and others launched, included Campbell said they were going to use it, and we put out an ad called Mm-mm Dead. You know, Mm-mm Good, we did Mm-mm Dead. Then Campbell's then pulled back. We then visited McDonald's, and they then announced they would not use genetically engineered potatoes. So that was stopped. Farmers, with some legal support, were able to halt genetically engineered wheat. Now imagine that. Imagine if all the wheat products out there were herbicide tolerant. A, all those more herbicides, Roundup, that would have been out there. And B, all your products contaminated. Well, that was stopped. We helped stop that, and farmers came together and stopped that. GMO rice, that's been stopped. I mean, think about that.
No, I didn't mean there had been victories. I just meant overall, there's such a big push by the corporate forces that, you know, we still have to be explaining, hey, no, it's not what they say. It's like this, and we have to do this to stop it. You know, I guess that will be always with us.
Yeah, well, because they have, you know, they've got so much more money than we have to get out their message. But that's another good thing that's happened. I mean, I hate to say a good thing because it's so scary. But, you know, with this 2,4-D and dicamba, people are beginning to realize finally that all this propaganda they've been hearing about biotech or GMOs, it's really just about herbicides, and now they want to use more and more dangerous ones because the other ones don't work anymore. And that's all over the newspapers, front page in the business section of the Times. San Francisco Chronicle just had a front page article. And I think people are now realizing, okay, now we understand what GMOs are all about.
Yeah.
But maybe we can finally get the right view on that, Charlene. But there's been lots and lots of victories and one always thinks back on Rachel Carson, you know.
Right.
When I talk to people, I say, you know, think of this one woman worked for 17 years in the government, and then she decides, as she herself has cancer, to write Silent Spring. And that, I mean, look at it. I mean, within 8 years, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, National Environmental Policy Act. I mean, really, people should never be, discouraged. We're required to be faithful, not always successful, but often we can be successful, and we have been. I mean, again, organic is the fastest growing sector in American agriculture. We, for the last 2 years, over the first two, not last 2 years, but 2009, 2010, I haven't seen the 2011 statistics, were the first 2 years in 50 years where we saw more American farmers, and that was almost 100% gain in organic, was from organic, and women farmers.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's, it's small, but it's an encouraging sign that we're seeing women farmers and that we're seeing an increase. I mean, by some counts, the EPA and others, and USDA, we're down to 500,000 real farmers in the country. It's great to see an increase,
I
mean.
I want to say, too, that there are several studies I discovered. They're in the book Relational Reality, that when you go onto this big industrial farm system, it disempowers people in the community. They're then contract workers, and the poverty and crime levels go up. And the faster the conversion onto these big industrial farms, the worse for the communities around there. So we'll have to leave that there. I just want to say there's so much benefit to going
true.
In the direction that you're advocating. But on your website, I saw a couple things I'd like you to explain to us. The first one is, what is this organic and beyond movement?
Well, organic, we like to think of organic at CFS, at Center for Safety, we like to think of organic as the floor of what we want to see in American agriculture, not the ceiling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's basically an input standard, as most of your listeners know. I mean, pesticides, herbicides, fertilizers, antibiotics. It's basically saying what you can't do, which is great, and we need to defend it. It's the beachhead. It's great. But we want to build a house above that floor, or basement, if you will. So we want to start with organic, but then beyond we mean local, appropriate scale, humane, and that's very important, and we'll talk about that a little bit, humane, socially just, and biodiverse, and all of that will also reduce the carbon footprint as well, so-called
mm-hmm.
carbon footprint. So again, local, appropriate scale, humane, socially just, biodiverse. None of those are really well represented in the current organic standards, and that's the house we have to build above organic, because mm-hmm. you can have an organic monoculture. We don't really, though they're working on it, we don't really have humane standards in the organic. I'm president of the board of Humane Farm Animal Care, which is certified humane, which is the best one out there. Please look for that label and buy if you do eat meat, certified humane. We worked hard on that. A local is not inorganic. Appropriate scale is not inorganic. So we want to start with organic. Some people say, I only want to do local, not organic. Well, don't do that. I mean, if it's local and it's sprayed with pesticides, do you want them to be local pesticides? I mean, if you get like a local cancer, is that better? And do you want your pesticides produced locally? So it's organic and beyond, not organic or beyond. So
mm-hmm.
we add to organic, local, appropriate scale, again, humane, socially just, and biodiverse. And social justice is also a really critical area. So that's the goal. That's the aim for all of us, I think, in the food movement, is to build on this floor of organic, this future house of food, if you will, in our country that reflects those deep values. I always say defend the standards, defend the organic standards, and evolve the ethic. Because
mm-hmm.
that beyond is really the ethic. So let's defend the standards and evolve the ethic. And we're seeing that, as you mentioned before, Charlene, with farmers markets, with CSAs, community-supported agriculture. We're seeing it all over the place. The growth is just so encouraging and so, you know, so empowering.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the great things about food, isn't it, Charlene? You know, which is that there's so much in this society that we can't change without doing civil disobedience. I mean, my taxpayer dollars are going into the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, which I disapprove of strongly, morally.
Uh-huh.
But I can't really change that. You know, I can't really control where the light in my office I'm sitting in right now in San Francisco. I don't really know where that light's coming from. We're helpless in so many ways, but with food, it's so empowering, you know, and you know that we can make changes tomorrow. You can say no to GMOs and get
right.
a guide. You can say no to industrial meat. You know,
right.
there's, you can go organic. You can buy local. You can get involved with your CSA. These are things you can do tomorrow to bring down this criminal industrial system that destroys 10 billion animals a year, you know.
That leads me to what's on my mind for the next question. What is that True Food Network?
The True Food Network is our grassroots arm. So it's CFS's grassroots arm. It's about 250,000 strong, and these amazing people, and it's free to join. We appreciate people who can contribute, but it's free to join, and we give you, you know, when you get part of the True Food Network, the CFS's True Food Network, you get all these alerts. So right now, for example, you can get on that site and you can comment to the FDA when over a million people have already done this saying we want labeling of GMO foods. Right now you can do that. You can get on the website right now. That goes directly to the FDA and goes directly to the White House. You can also get online and say do not approve these 2,4-D crops, for goodness sakes. Over 300,000 people have already done that. So you get the alerts, the True Food Network, and it goes in and says no. I mean, they were going to approve this genetically engineered salmon despite a lot of our legal petitioning, and we got a 500,000 people to say to the FDA, do not approve this GMO salmon, which represents a tremendous danger to native salmon around the world and this country as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so far they haven't. I think they were scared by a 500,000 people. I know that the administration is paying attention now that over a million, I think it's 1.1 million plus now, have said labeled GMO foods during an election year. During what's probably going to be, unfortunately, a close election, I think the Obama administration says, whoa, there's a large group of folks out there that care about this. So you can get on the True Food Network and get the alerts and respond, and it does make a difference.
Mm-hmm. And what's your sense of the Food Modernization Act? Is that really helping out us with this problem about antibiotics and the food we're eating, or not enough?
Obviously, you know, I support a full food agency. The Food Modernization Act is a good small step forward. But Rosie DeLauro and others are still pushing, as we are, for a large food agency. Unfortunately, even the minor but important advances in the Food Modernization Act, which would mean more inspectors, more food safety, more accountability demanded from the FDA to corporations, saying corporations, you have to be more accountable for what you're doing. Right now, the House is not even appropriating, the Republican-led House is not even appropriating the dollars to make that Food Modernization Act work. So here's our very food safety and their ideology, their radical anti-government, radical anti-regulatory ideology. They're not even providing money for the basic food safety inspections that the FDA can now do. So it's, if anything, would it reveal, you know, the complete bankruptcy of that ideology, knowing how many people suffer from foodborne illnesses, knowing how important it is to have safe food. They're so anti-regulatory in their Ayn Rand or social Darwinian or whatever misguided faith they've abandoned themselves to, that they won't even provide money for food safety, Charlene. I mean, we're talking about children being the ones, of course, always most exposed, and the elderly, to these that always more dangerous for them.
Right. All right, I have a last question. We have just a couple minutes, but before I ask that question, I want to remind people that the website for the Center for Food Safety is simply centerforfoodsafety.org. So it's all written as one word. Now, I've seen a couple documentary films about this, but I wonder what your sense of the cause behind the collapse of the bee colonies is.
Yeah, you can get on our website. We've just filed legal action against the EPA. We believe that the neonicotinoids, which is a group of systemic pesticides, which are neurotoxins, that they are a major player in the bee colony collapse disorder, and we have asked the EPA to ban, to rescind the approval of this group of systemic pesticides called neonicotinoids. It's critical. I mean, pollinators are so critical. If we had real ecological education, Charlene, people would know how important pollinators are, how important plankton is. These are, without these, we aren't going to be here, folks. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And so we have, you can get on our website. We have the petition there. We're going to be sending comments to the EPA saying you got to ban these neonicotinoids. They're killing the bees. And so we know in European studies and new studies have shown that these are really, if not all of the problem, certainly a large part of it. Has to be stopped. We need our pollinators. And in general, you know, people get on the website and, you know, I don't like the word consumer. You know, because it's, fires consume, and they used to call tuberculosis consumption. Let's not think of ourselves as consumers. Let's all think of ourselves as creators. All of us making every choice we can make to create a new food system.
Thank you so much. Andrew Kimbrell, yes, I want to thank you formally for coming on the program. And if you're a commercial beekeeper or a farmer being harassed by Monsanto or anyone else who wants to help out with this big effort, go to their website, Center for Food Safety. Okay, we'll now exit the hour, as we always do, by passing through the Arts Corner to stretch our mechanistically schooled minds a little bit. And because we've been talking today about food, I have a poem about, well, it's a food-like substance. Really, folks, where else but on this program are you going to hear a poem, a good poem, of course, in which Velveeta cheese figures prominently? Actually, this poem is less about Velveeta itself than a reflection on the space and time we call childhood. I cut this poem out of the New Yorker a few years ago, and I don't know anything about the poet, but her name is Liz Waldner, W-A-L-D-N-E-R. The poem is titled Sad Verso of the Sunny, and then she has a blank line, as in fill in the blank for the last word. So again, this is Sad Verso of the Sunny blank. Velt sounds good to me, like melt. Back when you could eat Velveeta and call it cheese. My grandfather's macaroni and cheese featured a whole brick of Velveeta. I liked peeling away its beautiful silver wrapper, Velveeta, Velveeta, all over in blue. The expanses of time in which there was this grandfather appeared endless when I was in them. Who could see to the ends of the plains and so see her end beyond them? Who could think to look? You, like Ohio and its vowels, went on forever. Just ate your macaroni and cheese, relishing the brown bubbles on top, then did the next thing. Were the next moment surrounded and held in it by all the things you didn't know would end. Nothing seeded, no portend, only geranium and melamine and thank you, everywhere preceded by some please. Our musical selection today is related to the fact that before our guest fell in love with the law and activism, he had a career as a concert pianist. Yes, he studied piano in New York and then in Vienna, and then he returned to New York City where he gave many concerts, including one at Carnegie Hall. Unfortunately, Andrew Kimbrell is currently away from his home right now on a trip to the Center for Food Safety's West Coast office, so he didn't have access to the tapes of his own concerts. However, he kindly suggested a 5-minute piece he often played as an encore. This is the Brahms Intermezzo in A Major, Opus 118, Number 2, played by an internationally known pianist Andrew got to know in Vienna, Paul Badura Skoda. Brahms wrote this piece in 1893, which was near the end of his life, and Andrew remarks that it carries the kind of remembrances of things past and poignant nostalgia that only years of deep living can bring. Yes, and I'd add to that that Brahms dedicated this intermezzo to Clara Schumann, a celebrated concert pianist with whom he once had a close relationship. After she was widowed, in 1856, in fact, there is some indication, according to her biographers, that she had hoped their relationship would progress. But alas, Brahms wasn't into it. So, this is a beautiful piece about poignant remembrance. Here's the Brahms Intermezzo in A major from his Opus 118. That was the Brahms Intermezzo in A major, Opus 118, number 2, played by Paul Badura Skoda. It goes out with a tip of my hat to Andrew Kimbrell for all he does for all of us in the areas of food safety and transforming the food system. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please rate it at iTunes. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Join me next week for our Mother's Day program.
when we'll honor all the biological mothers and all the cultural mothers who make it happen in our communities and beyond. We'll hear a little bit about something that's very bad for children's development, but you can easily get rid of it. And then we'll hear quite a bit about something that's very good for them, the growing eco-literacy movement in our schools. Till then, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.